The Movie Files, a podcast featuring behind-the-scenes tales of motion picture history. Sponsored by Aplomb Publishing. Visit us on the web at www.aplombpublishing.com.
Welcome back to the Movie Files. I am John William Law, your host. Thanks for tuning in. We're obviously going to talk about Ice Station Zebra this time. That's the name of the episode, and that's the name of the film. Ice Station Zebra is a 1968 film. It is an MGM spectacular, I guess you could call it, maybe. Interesting film. I recently saw it again after having not seen it for a long time, and that sort of made me sort of interested in it, interested in kind of looking back, thinking about it. It's an interesting film, partly because of the era that's made. I talk about a lot of films around this time because I do think that this time is a kind of watershed period in film history that I don't know that people have done as much kind of evaluation of as some of the other eras in film, and certainly in transition from things like, silent pictures to sound, or black and white to color. Those are kind of important times, but as movies become much more modern, or movie making became much more modern in the latter part of the 1960s, as I've mentioned on previous episodes of the podcast, the technology started to change a lot. And so it wasn't so much about what was seen on the screen, it was more about how the films were made and what was capturing the film from the sound equipment and the camera equipment, partly because in the old days, sound equipment and camera equipment and everything was so big. So everything was filmed on a movie soundstage, and they did that very specifically to control all of the elements around them so they could control everything so that sound was accurate and picture was accurate and lighting was accurate and all these things to capture the kind of elements of a picture were controllable. And so you look at a lot of famous directors like Alfred Hitchcock, very much grew up in that space, very much focused on the idea that they liked filming on a soundstage because they were able to control everything. Because when you're out in public, out in the real world, it's harder to control every element around you. And that's one of the reasons why they say lots of movies that are filmed on water, certainly like Jaws, for instance, became very, very difficult because you really can't control water. So in the latter part of the 1960s, technology started to change. So the camera equipment and the sound equipment started to change in scope and size and became much more manageable and smaller. And even today, you look at cameras, you can film an entire movie on your iPhone. Back in those days, when you had huge cameras that were very cumbersome to move around, you couldn't do as much as you could. So even filming in the real world was definitely an expense and a challenge. But as the 1960s wore on, or the end part of the decade, you started to see grittier, more real pictures, partly because the equipment that they were using was becoming much more portable. And Ice Station Zebra was made in 1968, so in a way, it's got kind of an interesting, spin on it, partly because of what it did and what it didn't have, because it doesn't have that same element of modernism, although it attempts to have some of it. The movie stars Rock Hudson, and Rock Hudson it's interesting in looking at the film. Originally, from what I had read, the original star of the picture they were going to use was going to be Lawrence Harvey. Lawrence Harvey, if you remember him from most famously probably Manchurian Candidate, the 1962 film, he was going to be the star of the film, but he backed out. I don't exactly know why, but for some reason at the end of the last minute, he backed out. Rock Hudson sort of stepped into it, and it's a sort of an interesting story for Rock Hudson, because Rock Hudson, at this time, he had been having some trouble in films. He had been fairly successful for many years, lots of big hits. Certainly the movies that he made with Doris Day in the latter 1950s into the early 60s were big, big successes, up into, I think, probably, maybe 64 or so, when he did Send Me No Flowers, I think was the last kind of those those kind of types of films, he started trying to move into some other areas, and he actually left a contract that he had at Universal in around 66 or so. He had left Universal and became a free agent. And being a free agent meant he had a lot more opportunity to choose the works that he would do. Rock Hudson, because he'd kind of grown up in the Hollywood system as an actor, a very young actor, and being kind of part of the last kind of phase of these kind of studio contract actors, he was from that old age. Even though he was relatively young, he was used to being kind of managed by a studio. He had, you know, teams of people who managed him, and they picked his films and told him when to sign up for work, show up for work, and he, you know, did all these things, and he did lots and lots of films over those years, and some very successful. Certainly got an Oscar nomination for Giant, did a whole host of films in the 1950s and 60s. But by 1966, again, he ended his time at Universal. He'd actually done a few kind of, I guess, you know, less successful films. He did a movie in 1965 called Strange Bedfellows with, I think, Gina LaBrigida. That was a bit of a failure. And then he'd done a couple other films, like a film called A Very Special Favor, Seconds, which was a kind of interesting experimental film, but certainly not a huge hit. Very odd film to talk about. I don't know. Maybe I'll do a podcast on it someday. And a couple of other films. He did a movie called Blindfold, a movie called Fine Pair. But nothing had really been a big hit for him. And obviously leaving Universal meant he was now a free agent, but it also meant he didn't have the same opportunity of people kind of handing him work. And apparently after he'd ended the contract with Universal, he kind of sat around for a while waiting for film offers to come. And there weren't that many that came by. So the ones that he did were these kind of, you know, ones that had already been either prearranged or were whatever had kind of shown up and were fit within what he thought was, you know, potentially a good film, but he wasn't always necessarily maybe the best choice of projects. So anyway, the films didn't do well. And he actually, around this time, got a call from his manager that told him that he needed to get back to work. He had had some time off in, say, 66, 67, and he hadn't really been doing much. And apparently he was down to something like $1,500 in the bank. And his manager said, you know, you really need to get back to work. And Rock Hudson was not a kind of guy who liked to manage his own money. He liked to have business managers take care of everything. So he didn't really pay attention to that sort of thing. And he always just assumed he had a lot of money and was always successful. So, and actually not unlike his co-star, Doris Day, who sort of did the same thing and suffered much more so at the hands of her own husband because of her own non-involvement in her finances. Rock Hudson was sort of in the same boat. So he knew he needed to get back to work, but he didn't have any projects that were coming his way. And he actually had a friend that he had known that was a publicist at MGM, and the guy was by the name of Tom Clark. And Tom Clark had knew he needed to get some work, and Tom Clark had called him one day and told him that, you know, there was a film that that they were making at MGM that was called Ice Station Zebra, and a guy by the name of Martin Ranzahoff was producing it. And Rock Hudson was like, wow, that's a great film. I would love to do that. It's actually based on a book. So it's based, I would say, pretty accurately based on a book, although not necessarily identical to the book. Although I have not read the book. But the film is based on a book by a guy by the name of Alistair MacLean, and it was written in 1963, and it was fairly successful. It was loosely based on some real events that took place in 1959. I won't go too much into the story, but basically the story is that a satellite in space has a camera in it. He's been taking footage of different things, and it gets out of orbit and it crashes into the North Pole, I guess it is, and in the Arctic. And it's got a kind of capsule in it with this kind of secret information in it. So there's a mission to basically rescue the castle, the capsule, or basically get the secret information that's here. That is a Soviet, was in like a Soviet satellite, I think is how the story goes. It's been a little while since I've seen this, seen the movie. Actually, I watched it a month or two ago. But basically, you know, the story goes that there's a group of people at a weather station in the Arctic, and they are suddenly incommunicado. There's been some major tragedy there. And so they mount a mission to go rescue them. But their real mission isn't really to rescue the people. It's to find out what happened to this capsule, get this secret information. And both the Americans, the U.S., and the Russians want it, and the British are involved. So there's a submarine that gets chartered to head there. And Rock Hudson is the kind of commander of the group of people that are on this submarine. And there's a kind of British agent who is played by Patrick McGowan to go and help kind of, and he's got the secret mission of knows exactly what he's looking for, but he's very secretive about not telling the military personnel what's actually going on. They just know that they're doing what they're told. And along the way, they end up picking up a couple of other guys, Ernest Borgnine, who plays a Russian kind of guy who, left Russia and escaped Russia and converted. He basically moved over to the other side is there to kind of sort of help in this because he knows the Russian piece of it, knows the Russian involvement, and knows how to help. Kind of do that side of it. And then there's Jim Brown, who plays a military guy who's kind of monitoring them all to kind of make sure everyone's doing what they're supposed to do. And then there's a fairly large cast of others, of military personnel. And I won't go any more into the story to kind of give away anything. But the thing about the film that's interesting is that it was an MGM big picture, in that MGM would make these pictures. They would try to make, you know, one big successful picture, make a lot of money off of it. And they spent a good amount of money on Ice Station Zebra. But the problem was that they filmed a bunch of live sequences of the submarine, and they developed like a special camera to do this. And so the scenes of the submarine kind of diving and coming out of the ocean are real. But the rest of the film, a lot of it is basically filmed on a soundstage. And it does look like that. There's lots of scenes where they built a big kind of top of a submarine. And so you can see shots of all the kind of crew that are standing out on the top of the submarine when it comes up on, you know, onto the surface. And they're all out looking at stuff. And you can see that it looks like they're on a soundstage. And then there's other shots of miniatures and things where they're kind of under the ice. And you can see them kind of trying to break through the ice to get to this, you know, this kind of Arctic, you know, wasteland where it's been, they've been having ice storms, and they're trapped and they can't get through the ice to kind of get in to rescue the people that are there. And so there's some miniature scenes of a submarine trying to break through this kind of ice storm, you know, under the ocean. And the ice, it looks a little, today, by today's standards, it looks a little manufactured. It doesn't look real. It looks like they're styrofoam. It looks like they're trying to crack through these things that are very kind of smooth and don't look the same like you would necessarily expect ice to look like. The movie did cost somewhere in the neighborhoods of $8 million to make, so they spent a good amount of money on, you know, cast, and obviously on a lot of the kind of expansiveness of the sets, even the sets that are at the, you know, in the kind of ice station area where they've got, it's covered in snow. It does look like a soundstage, but it's a big shot and there's a lot of people in it. So you can see where they spent the money. There aren't a massive amount of special effects in it. It's a very interesting film in terms of an action film. It's a guy film. I don't think there's a single woman actually in the picture. If I can, you know, from what I can remember, I don't recall ever seeing a woman ever in the film at all. It did do okay when it came out. It did relatively well for Rock Hudson. He needed a hit. He needed the money, needed the success, and he got something from it, so that was good. He used to, from what I had read, Rock Hudson at this time was kind of, because he wasn't working and because he was struggling as an actor, wasn't doing as well, it had been the first time he'd been very kind of successful for so long, he'd kind of gotten up onto kind of, some people said, like a high horse about his career, because he was kind of unstoppable and everything he did was a hit. And by this period, he had sort of bottomed out here. So he had kind of fallen down off of his high horse, so to speak. And he used to, had a drinking problem actually at the time. They said that Rock Hudson used to drink a lot. He drank a lot during the day and during the evening. And he actually, he had a habit, I guess you could say, or a rule that he lived by, which was after he ate dinner, he wouldn't drink anymore. So what happened for him during this period was that he started to push out when he ate dinner. So he wouldn't eat dinner until like 10 or 11 o'clock at night because he kept drinking. So he would want to have drinks, and people would say when they were ever invited to Rock Hudson's home for dinner, people would give them advice to say, well, make sure you eat first, because you know, you would be there and you'd start eventually asking, when are we going to eat? And he would say, oh, let's have another drink, let's have another drink. So he would kind of keep drinking. And then eventually they would have dinner. And then once he had dinner, he wouldn't drink anymore. But he finally did come out with a hit in this film. It made somewhere in the neighborhoods of $15, $16 million, I think, in the worldwide kind of film rentals box office around the world, which was good. I think it, I don't know if it got any kind of Academy Award nominations. If I recall, I think there were a couple of basically special effects nominations, which would have been all it would have gotten because of some of the kind of cinematography work that they did with the submarine under the ocean and things like that. I do know that around the same time, 2001, A Space Odyssey came out, and I know that that actually took home a bunch of special effects sci-fi kind of awards at the time, and probably would have definitely outshined Ice Station Zebra. So there's a little bit of look at Ice Station Zebra. It is available on video, DVD. I don't know if it's actually on Blu-ray or not. I haven't looked. I actually watched a copy of it, a digital copy of it. And so I know it is on iTunes and places like that. So if you have a chance, check it out. If you like Rock Hudson, he's definitely a huge part of the movie. He is in probably almost every scene. So if you like Rock Hudson, he is certainly front and present in all of the picture and actually does a pretty good job in it. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.